Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we pick a new book and we interview the author of that book. And this week I'm pleased to say we have Robin Greer on the show, and we'll be talking about her terrific book, The Long Process of Development, Building Markets and States in Pre-Industrial England, Spain, and Their Colonies. She co-wrote this book with Jerry Huff. Again, the title of the book is The Long Process of Development, and some of you may know that I'm a Russian historian. And I have to say that it's certainly the case that Russian development took a long time. So I'm in complete agreement with at least the title of the book, probably the whole book. It's an excellent book. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. I'm a professor of economics and international area studies at the University of Oklahoma. Almost all the classes I teach revolve around economic development. But my focus is on Latin America, and in Latin America, mostly Mexico. That's where I started my work in graduate school, and it's really kept my interest ever since, the political economy of Latin America.
Mm-hmm. So let me begin with the following observation. When
sure.
I was, I won't say young, but when I was in graduate school many moons ago, we, whoever we is, divided the world up into three areas: the first world, the second world, and the third world. The first world, of course, was us, because obviously, you know, we're going to be first.
Right.
The
exactly.
second world,
we're making the definition,
right, was them, and that is the communist bloc countries. And then the third world was everybody else. It strikes me that that way of categorizing the world, in terms of development, really has now gone away. What has replaced it?
I think that's absolutely true. It seems to have become politically incorrect. I would say that it's, you know, third world makes it sound somewhat derogatory and backward. We like our terms much more hopeful, optimistic at this point. And second world, of course, communist world has mostly transitioned away from communism, so we need different terms for that, too. This is something that I somewhat struggle with in my comparative economic systems class, because textbooks used to be very clear. You had the capitalist world, first world, communist world, second world, and like you said, everybody else, third world. Now they don't want to categorize it as such, but there is a big difference between the kind of legacy that communism left and so the kind of problems that post-Soviet countries have to deal with, as opposed to, you say, developing countries in Africa. And so it's worth making a distinction. I think nowadays we tend to use developed versus developing. And developing, like I said, is sort of hopeful, optimistic, you know, that they're getting better. We also use the term emerging markets, and that's typically used for ones that are superstar countries, or ones we hope are superstar countries. Tend to be like big countries like Brazil or Mexico. And they're emerging, I don't know, emerging exactly towards what, I'm not sure, but typically we've tended to be dynamic countries that trade a lot and that are growing in terms of GDP.
Mm-hmm. So I was going to ask you what development was, but I thought of something even more interesting and controversial to say. So how do you like that?
Okay, perfect.
The developed countries, that's the first world countries, that's us again. Is development just a polite way of saying Americanization? Because isn't it the case that all the metrics of developed country are basically American or European? So couldn't you just say, why don't you just say Americanization? You know, high GDP, cars flying around, eat a lot, you know, consume a lot of petrochemicals, you know, go vote when you want to, and you know, buy all your clothes at the Gap, I guess. I don't know. But you see what I'm saying? I mean, isn't it the case that it's just, that's what it is? I mean, but go ahead.
I mean, this is a big, something that we struggle with, and I think something we should struggle with, and also came up during the process of writing this book, too, is we don't want to make development seem like some linear progress, well, where the Shangri-La is America, or, you know, the Western world. So it's like, well, we define what development is, and all these countries that are underdeveloped, in some sense, have been put in this category of failing, or you know, not doing as well as we did, or not, you know, being further along. You know, they're not having caught up, or so we're defining what it means by development, and there's been a lot of backlash, not necessarily in economics, but in other disciplines, say anthropology, say that, you know, maybe some of these communities have their own ideas of what development is, and it doesn't match up with what you consider development. So they may have very different ideas of how they conceive time, what they think is fair, what they think is prosperous, and it may have nothing to do with GDP. And this is a really big issue that we talk about in my classes, too, mm-hmm. because my students in international area studies, they tend to be great students, just very sort of idealistic, but, you know, really want to make a difference, but at the same time don't want to impose, they don't want to be that person where they're imposing their ideas on other cultures. Mm-hmm. But then you run up against things like, say, we talked the other day about genital mutilation in sub-Saharan Africa. This is something that, you know, for Westerners, is something that's, you know, perhaps backward or something that we recoil against. So how do you decide, you know, do you say that all cultures are equally, you know, everything they do is equally fine and we can't impose what our beliefs are? Or do you say, well, no, we have this idea of what Western, you know, what development should look like, and it looks like us, and you should do this? So it's mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting philosophical question that economists should probably ask themselves more than we do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just to put my cards on the table, I'm only interested mm-hmm. in calling things what they are. And you mentioned anthropologists. I don't know if they're representative of this opinion. I don't think all cultures are equal. And I think if the whole world became America, that wouldn't be a bad thing at all. I've been to a lot of places overseas and they like McDonald's. Every place I've been, they like it. So, you know, I'm all for indigenous cultures. They're great. But I'm also all for people having enough to eat and voting.
Yeah, it's one of the most interesting part. It wasn't the main focus of a book, but there's this book that I recommend in my class on Mexican economic development. It's called God's Middle Finger. And it's this journalist who goes through, like, the toughest, roughest parts of northern Mexico. And he meets this guy who's trying to help out the Tarahumara Indians. You know, their land has been stolen from drug cartels, and they have very little education. And so he raises money in the United States for these people to help them. But he really struggles with the fact that he can't mention to people in the United States that, like, their culture is not something that some of the things, for instance, they want their land back, not because for, you know, traditional growing and that kind of stuff. They want to grow the poppies to make the opium. They're furious that they're not getting the drug money. They have no interest in educating kids. They don't see any interest in that. And so they want the land back for drugs. They want don't care about education, and they have I hope I get in the name of the Indian culture right, but they have a culture of high intoxication where they even give infants alcohol.
That's
and
terrific.
It's typical that adults will black out like three times a week.
Yeah.
And so this guy's trying to like present this to American audiences saying, you know, this poor native group needs your help without mentioning the fact that most Americans would not be happy with what they want to do, use the money for.
They really do need our help.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, the whole sort of, I guess, premise of development studies is sort of, it doesn't really take cultural relativism, so to say, at least in a very strong sense, very seriously, and that's okay. But can we say that, can we boil down development to saying that what we're really talking about is about progress for democratic capitalism, you know, sort of well-regulated markets and that kind of thing? I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
That's exactly what we're talking
Parliaments
about.
Parliaments and markets,
I just have to say, too, that I agree with you. I mean, one of the reasons that different countries try to block American imports, say, of movies and food and stuff, is that because people really like it.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm not saying that's good, but, I mean, it's very popular wherever it goes.
Yeah, I know. But, well, I could talk for a long time about this, but without being chauvinistic, by the way, because I'm a big critic of lots of things in American culture. So again, the title of your book is A Long Process of Development. How long?
So I also, there's sort of an inside joke. I wanted to title it The Long Process of Writing This Book.
Well, that could be the subtitle of every academic book.
But let me go back a little ways and say that when I was a graduate student, I got really interested in the political economy of Latin America. And I wanted to know, Douglas Norris has written a lot about the Spanish colonial legacy and how negative it was in Latin America. And I wanted to investigate whether this is really true, whether Latin American countries have done sort of more or less how we would expect after independence, and it's just that the U.S. and Canada tended to be superstars and make them look bad, or is it the fact that there was really something to the Spanish colonial legacy? And so that's what my dissertation was about, and I've got, you know, written some papers that came out of the dissertation on that. But this book was trying to look further and sort of turn Douglas North's argument on its head, and we say that it wasn't, you know, Spain was actually a very weak state, and we can get into this more, but that the legacy is not the one that, that Douglas North was presenting. And but to go back, we really want to look at, our argument is that some of the political and economic legacy of Mexico and the United States comes from the, you know, the state of development of England and Spain at that time. And I'm using Spain very generally because a lot of times during this time period, it really wasn't Spain. It was Castile, or, you know, it was a, what is now a province of Spain. But we found during this process that if we want to look at the political and economic legacy of, you know, political and economic development of England and Spain, we had to go back pretty far.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I stopped my co-author, Jerry Huff, when he started in like the thousands, the 1100s. I was like, oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
We can't go back to like the, you know, 1 AD or something like that. We have to sort of choose a point, and we did. We chose a point where we thought that Spain and England were actually very similar, those regions, and were good points of comparison. But this is something, and I know that you'll probably appreciate this, having studied Russia. Douglas North had argued that economists seem to ignore the fact that development takes time. We want answers. We want results right now, but it takes a long time. And we knew that we were going to have to trace out sort of the key parts of why it took so long and mm-hmm. why change is so difficult, and look at England and Spain, and then how that transferred into the kind of colonial legacies they left in the U.S. and Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because one of the empirical premises of the book is that in the English case, they developed what was a kind of I don't know if I should call it democratic capitalism quite early. They might have been the first to do so. And that their colonies, having received this institutional legacy, seem to have prospered thereby. Those
right.
being the United States and Canada and Australia. And I suppose, I don't know, does South Africa count? Maybe India, does it count? I don't know. And then you look at Spain, which was similarly configured about 1100, which did mm-hmm. not, and it, you know, they had a parliament and everything too. I forget what they called it. I wish I could.
The Cortes,
yeah. And, you know, but it did not, it was really not Spain, it was Castile. And then, you know, their colonies did not prosper in the same way. And this is a very interesting finding. I mean, it's
And the original argument in economics was because Spain was extremely bureaucratic, highly centralized, tried to regulate everything. And our argument is that it's actually just the opposite. It's the fact that Spain was so weak and had so little control. They tried to bureaucratize. They tried to regulate. They did a very poor job of that. That they, you know, because they were weak, they tried to highly regulate everything. While the English system became a much more centralized, much more capable government. And because of that, they were actually able to open up markets in the Atlantic world, and that led to big developments in both economic and political in the future United States.
Mm-hmm. Now, I said I wasn't going too deep in history, but just to talk about it a little bit, if you look at England and Spain in the, I don't know, 16th century, they're at war a lot. They look very similar for all the world. They've colonized the New World. They both have at least, well, by the 17th century, certainly people that claim to be absolutist monarchs, they say this.
Right.
Uh-huh. And, but what really differentiates, I mean, that's 500 years after you start. What differentiates them then? There are two putatively absolutist monarchs, and you're saying one isn't really very absolute at all.
Right. One isn't very, yes. And let me give you one of my favorite examples of that, and that is, so I think probably most of the audience has heard of the Spanish Armada.
Oh, yeah.
And the attack on England, right? So the idea that that they were going to, I'm not exactly sure exactly what they're what they were going to go for, but the idea was they were going to attack England with this incredible naval fleet. So this was at the end of the 1500s, and King Philip in Spain, he had a defense department, and it had only one person in it. It had one secretary and a couple of clerks that helped that secretary, and none of them had any military experience.
Yeah.
None of them had ever been in the military. None of them had ever run the military. So when he decides that he's going to launch the Spanish Armada to conquer England, he doubles his defense department to two,
uh-huh.
one for the army and one for the navy. And all of the ships, almost all of the ships, were actually rented from Genoa. So they weren't even Spanish ships, and which I think that leads to some funny ideas too. Like, you know, when you rent a car and they say, don't take it into Mexico or don't take it into Italy if you're in Europe or something, I'm imagining that conversation with the Genoans, like, yes, we rented your ships, but we took them to attack England, and mm-hmm. they're all at the bottom of the sea.
Yeah.
So most of them were sunk, but King Philip didn't try to rebuild any kind of merchant fleet. Which Elizabeth absolutely did. That was one of the keys that we found, is that she rapidly expanded her armed merchant fleet at the same time. It was sort of a part private, part public merchant fleet that she actually encouraged, not sure we would encourage this nowadays, but she encouraged these merchantmen to be pirates,
mm-hmm.
And she had rules. There were sort of informal rules that you couldn't attack Spanish ships too much, because then Spain would try to, you know, start a war, but attack them just up to that point. And so they were allowed. Pirates had to turn over some of their booty to her, but they were allowed to keep a fair amount of the booty too. So it was like this interesting private public partnership
mm-hmm.
of piracy. And pirates were very highly lauded. There were songs sung about them about, you know, taking down the Spanish. And so I think that gives a little bit of an idea of, you know, just how little bureaucracy, what kind of like a patrimonial system that Spain had at that time. And also the bureaucracy that they had to deal with for the Indies was, none of the people had ever, up until the Bourbons, none of them in the 1700s, none of them had actually been to the New World. None of them had any actual experience there. And they tended to, what's the best way to put this? They, even in the New World, the administrative units were huge, and there was very little bureaucracy. There was very little control. So for what we call Mexico now, New Spain, and they're not the same, because New Spain actually included most of the Western United States,
mm-hmm.
included Florida, included Venezuela, the Caribbean, and the Philippines. So at the time, New Mexico was about 15 times larger than Western Europe. And until late 1700s, it had no provincial institutions to coordinate sort of administrative lines of command. There was one viceroy with a couple of clerks. You sense the pattern here. A couple of clerks for that entire territory. I remember reading at one point where the viceroy was petitioning the king to get some more secretaries, because everything had to be written by hand, of course. And this is a huge territory to try to control. And in this territory, they had three different tax agencies, one for agriculture, one for the Native American villages, and one for what they call the Spanish sector. None of these had any officials that could be appointed or removed by the viceroy. So the viceroy had no control. He had no real military force in the core areas of the colonies. He didn't have any power really over taxation, and he had no bureaucracy. So this idea that Spain was this sort of overwhelming, imposing bureaucracy that was constantly, shadowed people, and it was just really not true at all. Spain was extremely weak, and they had very little control over what happened in their colonies. By the 1600s, I mean, at one point, 50% of Mexico's silver, which was its primary export, 50% was being smuggled out to European countries.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that they had this highly regulated trading system, they tried, but they didn't actually succeed. And the argument is, one of the reasons they tried is because they had such a weak state, they couldn't They didn't have control over taxation, and they couldn't have a free market system like the English did.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did the English manage to develop this administration, this very well-organized, I don't know if it's well-organized, and I don't even know if it's an administration or bureaucracy, I don't know what to call it. How did they come to govern so effectively where the Spanish could not?
Part of it was a little bit geography, and I'm going to try to simplify way down over many centuries of history and lots of details that are in the book, but in England, they tended to focus, the king originally tended to be sort of the most powerful warlord in the London area, and really focused, the king focused on getting power over London, and it was like many hundreds of years before they could get, you know, capable administration and rest of what we call England now. It took a long time, but they focused on getting a fair amount of power, taxation ability. One of the reasons they were able to do this is they allied with the Hanseatic merchants, which did have military power, and they sort of, I don't know what you would call it in modern days, because it would be almost like a contracting military power, but it gave them power of taxation. Mm-hmm. The Hanseatic merchants made sure that no one, or tried to make sure that no one was smuggling, and they were actually able to impose, enforce, and collect wool taxes because of their alliance with the Hanseatic merchants. So they focused on a very small area, and once they got power over that area and started to get a little bit of administration, then they started to branch out. In Spain, it almost hurt it because it was so, there were so many different ports. The king was afraid of, choosing one port over another because causing backlash in other ports, and kind of took on too much. There was, took on so much territory that they were unable to really control any of that territory. And
mm-hmm. Well, this is precisely what happened in Russia as well.
Oh, okay.
Is that when Muscovy was quite small, it might have been relatively intensively governed and maybe even well governed. Once it became a continent, then it was impossible to govern it, and they did not have the means to bring it under control. So what they did is they ran from one area to another area, putting out fires, and that's not a good way to develop institutions. And the best way to put out a fire is to kill everybody.
Right.
Because that's really your only tool. I mean, you can't negotiate with them or anything because there's another fire you have to go to over here. And so you have to quickly get the army over there now. So you don't have time to negotiate or set something up. You simply, just be brutal and then you go someplace else. And so the result by the 19th century is that the place is incredibly undergoverned. But by American standards even. I mean, there just really aren't many as a proportion of the population or as a proportion of the territory. There just aren't that many people running the place. And just not enough. There's just not enough of them. And it's a terrible situation. And it's arguably the situation today. I mean, the place is still undergoverned. Go ahead.
No, no, that's exactly what we're talking about. That's a fantastic analogy.
If you're stretched
to go ahead.
I was going to say, if you're just, they were just stretched too thin. And, you know, this is something that happens to businesses, and it happens to baseball teams, and it happens to lots of different kinds of organizations. They just take on more than they can actually digest, and it's the end of them. It's the end of a lot of them, at least. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of what the king of Spain, I think some economists tended to just believe too much the king's own, the royal interpretation of events, because they'd be like, we're collecting these taxes. But if you actually look at it, they're not collecting the taxes. I mean, sometimes it's like forced gifts. Sometimes they're farming most of the time, for most of this period, they're farming out those taxes. A lot of what they count as taxes aren't what we would consider taxes nowadays. So there's a mythology, I think, about, the strong state. But when you actually look at it, you're right. It was totally undergoverned. And same thing, like I was saying, in New Spain, it's a huge amount of territory.
It really is. And if you look at it on a map, it doesn't give you a good impression of what's actually going on because it's so large. It's a lot of North America. And then if you think about, you know, just a little fact, not to bring up too much history, but at this time, Philip II also controlled the Netherlands. Now, what the hell were they doing there? And had a claim on the
Naples.
On the he had a claim on the Austrian territories as well. The world? How could he? You know, how could you ever control such a territory? You know, it's just not really possible.
It's absolutely true, and they did. And somehow they, in the literature, they really managed to seem like they were all powerful, or you know, that. But when you actually look at it, it's sort of like a. An emperor has no clothes type situation, right. Or a paper tiger, or you know, there really wasn't a lot of administration going on. There really wasn't a lot of control. And if you just look at like where the capital cities were put in Latin America, Spain, for one thing, they were interested in taking riches out of the region. And something that I think we forget is that Spain went first in the colonization, and they got what were considered the good parts.
Mm-hmm.
And the good parts were the ones with gold, ones with silver, and ones with lots of Native Americans that you could, you know, especially exploit.
It's funny. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I always, you know, I'm in England right now, and I always joke to people that the Spanish knew everything about the area, which is now Massachusetts, but they considered it uninhabitable, and they weren't wrong.
Well, that's
so they went south.
It's true. They had better weather. They had better everything. And so Spain went second. I mean, Britain went second and got like what were considered like the crumbs.
Yeah.
These were not considered to be good places. They tended to turn into like to have good institutions. But at the time, estimates of income, Mexico was quite a bit richer than sort of the British colonies. And we're not even talking about Canada. My gosh, when Britain decided to get Canada from France, they were just made fun of. They were saying, no, Canada's a pile of snow.
Yeah.
Nobody has ever developed anything at that level of latitude. There's just, why would you do that?
And so it is today. I'm sorry. Wait.
So it is.
Sorry. Canadian listeners, I'm sorry.
And then so Spain was mostly interested in extracting riches, and they tended to put their capital cities on like plateaus, which tended, you know, they didn't have problems with yellow fever and malaria, that kind of things, and it was good for defense because you could see who was coming, but very bad for trade and transport. And on the other hand, you have England that replicated their experience in London, where the colonists would come to the mainland, and they would invariably set up shop. Well, most of the time in the very beginning, they just died, right? I mean, things did not go well. But once they did establish there, they established near a good ocean-going port, or at the very least, a river, a navigable river that led to the ocean. And they tended to be very small. They tended to be very small provinces, very small states, as opposed to, say, New Spain, which was gigantic. So it's not like they needed that. They had that much administration on the British mainland, but administrative units were quite small, and so you didn't need a ton of bureaucracy like you did if you were trying to control a gigantic territory like the King of Spain was. And this, of course, is going to be really helpful for trade, right?
Because I was going to come to trade.
I
was going to come to trade, and you kind of have a paradox here. At least it seemed to me by looking at your book, and that is that neoliberal economics, as it was kind of recreated, I suppose, in the 20th century, says small states are the state that governs least governs best, at least in terms of economics, and that may be true in this context. But I think what your book shows is that a certain amount of state involvement is just absolutely necessary in order to create those well-regulated markets that Adam Smith knew all about. And in a place like Spain or Russia, the Russian state was very well designed to take rents. That's what it was for. You know, it was entirely for that. And it didn't do anything else. It did not administer justice. It did not clean the streets. It did not build streets. It took rents
in the form of taxes. That sounds like Spanish authority.
You know, well, except that Spanish had a really good place to take rents, and the Russians did not.
Right, okay, yeah.
But can you talk a little bit about that difference?
That's a good point, and it's something that was sort of surprising to me as I was going through, as I was working on this book, because I come from a very libertarian background, and most of what I had studied in development was government screwing things up. And I felt like a lot of times that, you know, the governments were creating problems, that government policies, they were overregulating, they were creating uncertainty. And so my background is sort of more towards, you know, economic liberalism and political liberalism, liberalism in the old sense. And then the more we're researching this book, we realize that, like, economists don't really know that much about how to build markets. And you actually do need a capable state. You do need an administration that works. You need to have state capability. You need to have a justice system. You need to have roads. There's things that you need to have a modern market, which I had never really thought about. I don't think most economists think about. And take your area of the world in the post-communist states. There's a great, we have a quote actually from Alan Greenspan, which is a little strange
that.
To hear him
I
in this
saw
context.
That 1977. Yeah.
Right. But he says, Alan Greenspan says, turns out we had no idea what we were doing. We just sort of thought that we would take away the communism and markets would just spring up.
Yeah.
And we knew there would be growing pains, but I mean, the idea, I'm not. Actually, these aren't his words, but this is sort of the idea that we just thought that markets would happen naturally, and it didn't matter if you had strong states, and states are, you know, the problem with the communist states is the states were too strong, and so we get rid of that, and voila, we have modern markets, and that's not what happens.
Yeah.
And you end up getting, you know, kleptocracies and massive corruption, and so that was a real learning experience for me, that it was the strength of the English state. Now, I think it's probably nonlinear, right? I mean, I don't think that the stronger the state, necessarily the better the market, but that the state has to have some kind of capabilities to really be able to have free trade and to create a modern-looking market.
Right. Well, I mean, if you just think about the American Revolution or the Boston Tea Party, it was over a stamp tax. A stamp tax is pretty sophisticated. Right.
Yeah.
That's not just nothing. That didn't just grow up overnight.
Right.
Somebody didn't walk in and say, "Hey, I think we should have a stamp tax."
Right.
The Russians couldn't do a stamp tax in 1768. Are you kidding me?
Right.
They couldn't do anything like that. So, you know, even there, it's pretty well regulated, you know, a stamp tax. Come on. I mean, that's, you know, people are thinking, yeah, sure, of course, we have to pay taxes, but it's too much. And, you know, that's not the terms in which Russians thought. I don't know about Spanish, but they didn't think that way. They thought you owe the czar and that's it. And he says how much.
Right.
And if you don't give it, the soldiers are coming, you know, and you can run south onto the steppe like everybody else, you know. But I was thinking about, you know, we can see unregulated markets in operation in American inner cities in drug markets. And the same thing happens to them every time. They consolidate, right? And a bunch of people get killed. And,
right.
And that's what happens to them, right? It's not as if they say, okay, you get this street corner and I get that street corner. And well, we'll have the police come and make sure everybody, you know, is having fair and equal you know, competition, and if we feel like you're monopolizing, we'll go to court, and, you know, all this other stuff. We'll have standards for our products and, you know, that kind of thing. We'll make sure we protect the consumer. That's not the way it works. There's no regulation. So it goes to guns immediately.
After it turns to violence, because there's no other way to enforce.
Well, and that's what happened in Russia in 1991. That's what happened. It was like there used to be a bunch of sellers, and now there's one. And you can't sell anything without that guy telling you can sell something. And that's it. And that's a badly regulated market right there.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
And to bring it back historically, some because in the English colonial system, Englishmen were allowed to trade freely in the empire and in the Atlantic Empire. And if you were a colonial merchant or shipper, you were considered an Englishman. So you could they taxed certain goods like sugar, indigo, rice, tobacco. Other than that, they call them enumerated goods. Other than that, you could trade with no tax, no tax whatsoever. And they started trading, and it was sort of a virtuous cycle where at first they sort of had to trade in kind with Caribbean countries, right? There wasn't any real money, so they were trading goods for goods. And then they had to dispose of those goods once they got back to, say, New England. And so then they started opening up retail trade, and they started cattle ranching, and they started all these different things, and they became very entrepreneurial. And then they were interested in better harbors and roads. So they were allowed to trade with the other states. They were allowed to trade with Caribbean English colonies. In Spain, they weren't allowed to trade. I mean, there was periods where they traded with I'm calling Mexico, but New Spain traded with Peru, but it wasn't legal. And so Spain was constantly trying to stamp that out. So colonies were not allowed to trade with other colonies. They were not allowed to trade with any other European countries. The convoy of Spanish ships were supposed to come once a year. Sometimes they didn't come for several years at a time if Spain was at war. So that's where they were only supposed to get their provisions. And yes, there was massive smuggling that went on in the 1600s, but that doesn't quite lead to an entrepreneurial culture. Because you
Yeah. Smugglers are not entrepreneurs, really. That's a different thing.
It does teach us some entrepreneurship, just probably like drug trade does, too. Russia in 1991, it takes some entrepreneurship and some risk-taking. And But there's no formal institutions. There's no judicial system. There's no it's not formalized at all. There's no recourse.
Yeah.
And so smuggling is not the same as creating an entrepreneurial culture that has institutions to support it. And in fact, like the New Englanders were allowed to build ships for colonial shipping. And during the English Civil War, there was hardly any English ships, so they like took off. And I think it was by the end of the colonial period, it was like a third of the ships of England's fleet was produced by, I think it was Boston. So, and on the other hand, when Mexico was finally allowed to trade with the United States, when the empire was disintegrating, they found they had no shipping because they weren't allowed to do it. They had no ships. And so it's like, well, you can trade now, but you have no ships.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have any of the sort of the trappings of a modern market. You just have sort of smugglers and this underground market.
Yeah.
So it's really not the same. Things were changing in Mexico, but that's one of the things we argue is that I'm not saying that independence came too soon, but they were starting to look toward the British and see the success that they had and starting to really change things up. But almost immediately after that, then you have the war between Spain and France. You have Napoleon putting his brother on the Spanish throne. And then you have long wars of independence. And so it seems like the culture might have been changing, but it didn't really have time to solidify.
Yeah, you mentioned alcohol and tobacco and I suppose tea and coffee and these things, which are some of them come from overseas, not alcohol, but they are highly taxable, and the English made a fortune of taxing them. But I was thinking about what happened to them in the Russian case. In the Russian case, they didn't tax them. They just made them state monopolies. That seemed like a better way to go, you know?
Yes.
And we know how well states run enterprises, so that's going to work really well.
Such a history of success.
Yeah,
yes.
And you know, it's just, yeah, it was rational too, because they, you know, they knew there was no market that they could actually set up that would work well. So if they're going to get anything out of this, they're going to have to monopolize it. And that's what they did. And of course it crushed it as a market, but you know, they got something out of it and that was good. But that's the way they thought, you know, that it was, you know, look, people are now smoking tobacco. That's a fire to be put out quickly. We have to get control of that. so they did. Yeah.
That's amazing how many, it's funny because my co-author is a Russian expert, but on sort of more modern Russia.
Yeah, he does
Russia,
modern stuff,
it is amazing how many great analogies there are from the Russian case.
Well, the Russians did this with land. They could, you know, the English had it very well, sort of, you know, officially, of course, all land is held of the king or queen, but that of course, that's just a fiction. In the Russian case, it was real. You know, they couldn't set up a system by which people could actually have deeds that were transferable. This is, of course, in the 16th and 17th century. And so they basically just monopolized it all. They did that with labor, too. They did that with labor. They did it with the peasantry. They said, we're just going to be serfs. You know, we can't allow a free market in labor. We'll just monopolize it.
You know? Right.
I mean, you know, and it worked for a while.
Yeah.
Until it didn't, you know, so.
And it comes from a, in some sense, of a position of weakness.
Exactly. They don't have the means to do it in a better way. This is all they have. And, you know, they have that hammer and everything is a nail, and that's what they do to everything. And, you know, again, it was rational in that context. It was quite the rational thing to do. And it served them really well, I should say. You know, it saved them. It definitely saved them. But its legacy in terms of development is horrendous.
It's terrible.
Truly horrendous. Yeah.
Oh, that's really fascinating. It's really interesting talking to you about this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not really a historian of Spain or England, but it is interesting knowing that the Spanish. I mean, you know, you can kind of see it a little bit in the way that, in the way these empires have developed. I want to talk a little bit about the modern implications of your book, and I think that. I've been researching a book on the Vietnam War recently that I'll probably never write. And I've been listening to these wonderful recordings that they have on the web of academics talking about development in Vietnam. And of course, it's all going to be done by 1974. And land reform. And that's going to do it just like that. And,
right.
and now you can, you use it, in the early 2000s, sort of late 1990s, you could hear the same sort of thing. We'll go into Afghanistan or Iraq, and what we'll do is we'll implement some reforms, and then, development will proceed apace. Or you will hear the World Bank or the IMF say, yeah, we'll loan you a whole bunch of money, but it's contingent on you pursuing the following policy of liberalization. And once you do that, well, then everything's going to be done by, 2020, and you'll be, a full-fledged liberal. So I think a lot of people, what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's, I have a couple different thoughts on this, so I hope I don't go on too long.
No, go ahead.
But it's one of my favorite topics. So, for one thing, if I back up a little bit, there really wasn't, up until like the early 1800s, all countries were pretty poor. I mean, there was like...
That's true.
Or, if you look at like a graph of what we estimate, world income, everyone was poor. And so it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution where some countries started to break out. And it wasn't until early 20th century when we started having national accounts. And so we sort of knew anecdotally that, you would hear accounts of travelers that went to Paris or went to, and you'd hear like, oh, wow, they got this and they got that. And so you knew that they were perhaps richer. But it wasn't until economists came up with actual numbers and that people could rank the different countries and realize, wow, we're really far behind. And it actually made some countries really mad. It made New Zealand really mad because at the time it was considered to be really bad to have really unproductive and have service industry. So they were furious at economists as a lot of their economy was service related, which is funny because nowadays that's actually a good thing. Mussolini was furious that Italy was considered so underdeveloped relative to other Western European countries. So there was some, plot. And so I think it was a recognition that there is this thing development. And some countries are more developed than others. And then there was a couple things that made people realize that maybe we can do something to speed along the process. So you have the Russian Revolution, and while I think there's a lot of paper tigerness to the Soviet state too, I mean, that's sort of weird to say given what happened in the Soviet state, but what I mean is I think it took a while before we realized how unproductive the system was. But for a lot of outsiders, like I had a student from Ethiopia, and he was telling me, oh, Stalin is really, he's a real hero in Ethiopia. I was like, really? Wow. And he's like, oh, yeah, I mean, Russia went from like this backwards feudal country to standing up, toe-to-toe with the United States. And
industrial country.
Yeah, I was like, well, what about all the... And so, but I think for developing countries, it was this narrative that we don't have to take hundreds of years. We can do this. We can catch up fast. And also, I think probably a little bit the Keynesians and the Great Depression before with classical economics, the idea was you fall into a depression and that's it. You wait until, wait till things work themselves out. Keynes came along and said, no, the government can do something. So once that got in people's minds, if the government can do something, they should do something. And so this was used by a lot of post-colonial, newly independent sub-Saharan African countries as a narrative. It's a very powerful narrative that we're going to catch up. We've been held down by the colonialists, which is probably true, and we're going to catch up. We're going to catch up quick. And I think there's also it's just human nature to want to do things to not take the time that it might take to do something. And I saw this the other day. I saw a sign in the city that I live, and it said, lose 30 pounds in a week, mm-hmm. call this number. And I thought, 30 pounds, you'd have to cut off a body part. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like 30 pounds. But I thought, there's probably desperate people who are thinking, excellent, if I could just get this done in a week, rather than taking, you know, a couple months. Or so I think there's this human nature, something in human nature. We want shortcuts. We want to figure out how to do it fast. And development economists have not, unfortunately, been immune to this, and they don't seem to learn much from history. We sort of collapse down our own history. We forget our own history. Hernando de Soto has a fantastic book called The Mystery of Capital. And he looks and finds out that almost no one in the United States knows the history of property rights in the United States. And we thought it was like, well, we did it. Why can't you, you guys just mm-hmm. create a property system? We found out it was really, really hard to do in the United States. It took many, many, many generations. And in fact, like George Washington asked his lawyer what he should do about the fact that there was constant squatters on his territory, on his estate. And he's thinking of evicting them, and the lawyer said, don't do that. They'll just come back and burn your house down. And there was a Supreme Court justice in the early United States who said, it looks like we're never going to figure out this property rights situation. We'll always be a nation of squatters. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at how difficult and how messy and nonlinear it was in the United States, it's amazing. But we forget about the historical part, and we just see the end result and think, well, why can't these countries just do it? Just the great paper by Lant Pritchett and Michael Wolcock, and they call this phenomenon called skipping straight to Weber. And it's like, just mimic what we did. Mm-hmm. Just copy what we did. And ignoring the fact that these institutions are coming from nothing. They're not coming from an internal historical process of trial and error, of political struggle, of hundreds of years. And so there's this tendency to overpromise and to somewhat believe the overpromise. Like, this time, yes, we don't really know how to build markets and states, but we're going to do it, and we're going to do it fast. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's very palatable. That's very attractive to states that are poor. They want to hear, how can we do this quickly? And I don't think you have to completely reinvent the wheel. Obviously, you can learn from other countries' experiences and stuff, but I think there's something to be said for the fact that, it's going to take a while. Culture changes, for one thing. Just putting these institutions on poor countries doesn't mean then it's going to work well. I think that's something that we found, but we haven't seemed to learn. I mean, there's one thing, the one point that we make in the book is Douglas North argues that economists have not taken to heart the fact that institutions matter, and I think they have now to a good extent sort of focused on institutions. But his other thing that he had to say was that we haven't taken into effect that time matters. And I think that development economists want to promise, sort of overpromise about what policymakers can expect, and it leads to, no one wants an advisor that says, well, just wait for a couple hundred years and you'll probably be richer, mm-hmm. It'll probably take 200, 400 years, but, yeah. You'll get there.
Yeah.
No one wants to hire a World Bank consultant that says that.
No.
So they want fast results, and the problem is it's not based on anything institutional, historical, political in their country, and mm-hmm. it doesn't take.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we can kind of see that all around us in a way. A good example is the role of time. A friend of mine said, It's really wonderful what's happened with gay rights in the United States over the, last, say, decade or so. Of course, it started in the 60s, so it's been a little while already. But, gay marriage, I remember when they started talking about gay marriage, I was like, there's no way. But it turns out people changed their mind, right. Or at least half of them did pretty quickly. But this friend of mine said, it's going to – probably one generation or maybe two will have to die before gay people are equal in the United States. I think he's right. Mm. Yeah. And so what's that mean? Yeah. Our generation's now 50 years. I mean, so that's 100 years, maybe 100 years from now, people will think, it won't register.
Absolutely.
But it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen the next day.
Yeah.
People have to die because they hold my mother of blessed memory would not really have liked gay marriage. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And she would not change her mind, even given this really rational argument. That just doesn't count. She wouldn't feel it. And so,
Absolutely right. It's generational change, and that takes a while. You can't just impose it and expect it to take. You see that with racism, too. I mean, I love my grandparents, and I think my grandfather turned out to be pretty non-racist for his generation. But, like, my grandmother, I didn't realize until she was, like, very old that, like, oh, my gosh, she's really quite racist. It wasn't until she actually got Alzheimer's and she forgot that she was racist.
Right.
But the feelings that you have,
their sentiments, you know, you really can't get rid of them very much. It's like when you feel gross when you see a spider or something. I mean, it's like at that level. And, you know, my father used the N-word in free-flowing speech a lot, and he didn't think a thing about it. And you know, of blessed memory again. And I don't think he would be, you know.
Still around.
No, he wouldn't be keen on gay marriage either. Although I think he might be more liberal than my mother. But anyway, to get back to this sort of very contemporary meaning for your work, and that is what when we go over and we talk about nation building and stuff, what could that possibly mean?
That's a good question, because it's hard. Like I was saying before about, you know, do you hire a consultant that says it's just going to take a long time? But one thing I think you can look at is you can be more have a better historical idea of what actually happened in our past. You know, how long it took the United States to figure things out, how long it took England to, and those are the two good cases, right? Those are the ones that went still the fastest. Russia, you know, what happened there? To have this in mind and to try to come up with solutions for development that take into account where that country is actually at.
Mm-hmm.
So some sub-Saharan African countries have taken to farming out taxes, which I find amazing.
Yeah.
And I mean, because this is exactly what every European country did when they didn't have the institutional capability to collect taxes themselves. And it's actually, from what I can tell, it actually seems to be working. And so sometimes you might want to go for what's second best rather than go straight to, like I said, straight to Weber, where they call it also straight to Denmark. They just pick
straight to Denmark, right.
Straight to Denmark, or, you know, choose something that, you know, that makes sense with the level of capability that they have there. Look to history for how these things were resolved. Not just expect them to have all of the institutions and the infrastructure and stuff to be able to do rich country solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need a lot more. We need a lot more humility. We need a lot better understanding of history, and I think we have to be more creative and not just assume. I mean, when I got out of grad school, I had an interview with someone from the World Bank, and she was telling me about some police reform project that they had that worked so well in New Zealand, and they were shocked because it worked really poorly in Mexico City. And it was just overtaken with corruption. And I was just looking at her thinking, New Zealand, in like rankings of corruption, New Zealand is always like the least corrupt country in the world, one or two. And Mexico is, I don't know where Mexico's at, but it's not one or two, right? It's way down the list of rankings of corruption. So why would you think that you could just take a reform that worked well in this rich, developed, uncorrupt place and just copy it into a place? You know what I mean? It's like that level of error just seems shocking to me at the time. Like, what went wrong that you guys didn't think that through?
Yeah.
And you're admitting to it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I was going to ask you, one of the policies is very controversial, and I don't really know what I think about it because I don't know very much about it or how it's implemented. I mentioned it before, and that is, I guess it's the World Bank or the International Development Fund. I forget what it's called. They will loan money to these developing countries, but they always put strings on it. They attach strings, and the strings are usually about liberalization of markets.
Yeah.
And so does your research suggest that that's kind of a bad idea, that is, linking the loans to liberalization? Because if they did liberalize their markets, the markets wouldn't work.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean.
I think, yes, absolutely. I understand the strings, and I understand what they're getting at, but it has not brought about the expected outcome that they were hoping, and I think that's in good part because of stuff that we talk about in our book. I think you're exactly right. So I think focusing more on not just neoclassic certain neoliberal, you know, get the state out, but realize that maybe the state needs to come out in some areas, but the state needs to be much more capable in other areas. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that deals with tricky issues of sovereignty, too, and mm-hmm. that's hard to do. But I think, you know, realizing that just reducing this, you know, you can't deregulate before you regulate, I think we say in the book.
Right, yeah, that's right. That's very well put.
Some of these states aren't even able to regulate.
Yeah,
they have great laws on the books. You look at Mexico's laws, they're wonderful.
Yeah, well, they're beautiful.
But none of them are, a lot of them aren't enforced. So the mm-hmm. question is, not just liberalizing on paper or whatever, you know, getting actual state capability, and how do you do that? You know, increasing tax revenues. One of my students asked me yesterday, why don't they just tax more? I don't understand. And this is like a very poor country. I was like, it was Venezuela, which of course has, they said, why don't they just tax the rich a lot more? Oh yeah, if it were only that easy. There's massive tax evasion. There's massive rent seeking, corruption, so many different issues. So a lot of these countries do not have the ability to tax very well. So finding ways to solve that would be a lot better than just sort of, you know, getting the government out of things.
Right. So what, you know, this kind of leaves us sitting on our hands or feeling kind of glum about our ability to help, but what can we do to help? I mean, I suspect we want to help. I want to help, you know, I'd like everybody to be able to go to McDonald's if they want to and vote. So how do we help?
Well, this is going to be perhaps more just my views and not necessarily directly from the book, but I don't know if I'm speaking for Jerry on this, but I think a lot of times we like to help, but we don't like to think about the follow-up, the follow-through. So a lot of us, and myself included, have given money to charity and felt good about myself for giving money to charity, but I never necessarily follow through to make sure, you know, how are they spending their money, how is their finances, what are they, you know, is the act of doing it and you feel better and you go on with your life. I think it was Bill Easterly who said, a prominent World Bank critic, economist, who argued that the IMF programs, these neoliberal programs, have been good for everyone but the patient. They've been very good for the World Bank. IMF, the World Bank has 12,000 plus employees. It's been very good for those bureaucracies, but it's been very, very bad for those countries.
Yeah.
They're on merry-go-rounds of debt that they're never getting off. And so I think, you know, instead of feeling glum, I think the first, it's cliche, but the first thing you have to do is realize you have a problem. It might be working out really well for the bureaucrats, for the technocrats, but you're not actually doing anything helpful. You're actually making things worse. So just the realization of that, I think, is a start. And also, personally, I think that one of the best things you could do is to trade with countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of imposing, instead of giving aid, instead of giving loans, instead of imposing, you know, how are you going to use this money, stuff like that. Let them decide how they're going to use the money by opening up our markets to them.
Yeah.
You know, and so we give all this aid to sub-Saharan African countries when really, if we just completely open our markets to sub-Saharan African countries, it would be a huge difference. That's something that Britain's actually doing. Their aid agency, the DFID, is starting to focus more on trade rather than aid. And because it rewards entrepreneurship, it creates wealth, and it allows them to, the agency, the opportunity to create it in the ways that they want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how most countries have gotten rich, mm-hmm. not through aid.
Yeah, no, that's right.
And,
that's right.
So I think there are ways, but I think we like to just give aid and feel better and feel like we've done our job. And, you know, if they don't get rich, then we just blame it on them. Like, I guess they're, you know, whatever problems they have.
Right.
But I think that, you know, giving the opportunity is always better than just giving out money.
Yep. Yep.
So
that's true.
And like I said, I don't know if the trade part, Jerry would, I think he would agree, but that's just from my work on development. That's what I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. A trade is empowering. Aid is not. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So anyway, we've taken up a lot of your time, Robin, and I want to thank you very much for being on the show. We have a traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, that's a good question. It's been so, this book project, when we first talked about it, we thought it was going to be about a year long, year and a half. It turned out to be
the long process of this
How
book.
How wrong we were. It turned out to be 8 years.
They're all 8 years. That's the standard.
So now it's sort of like, coming through something, going, okay, now what?
Yeah.
My husband and I lived in Mexico for a while, and we would really like to write a book. I teach a class on Mexican economic development, and when I created that class, I realized there's really no good books on the political economy of Mexico in modern times.
Uh-huh.
So I'd sort of like to take some of this book, which ends in the 19th century, and update it to a certain extent,
uh-huh.
trace through the colonial legacies, talk about some of the major problems that Mexico has now. And another thing that I'm doing with a former graduate student is she has a lot of sort of municipal and household data on crime, investment, human capital. And I think that's a really, really interesting topic right now. The levels of crime are just astounding in some places in Mexico
mm-hmm.
because of
yeah.
the drug trade. And so we're going to look and see how crime affects like new investment, how it affects kids' decision to stay in school, things like that. So still focusing on Mexico, but just investigating from different angles.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with that. It sounds fascinating. You know, Mexico is an absolutely beautiful place, and I envy you. You know, I always say, you know, I don't know how I chose to study Russia, but when I studied Russia, I ended up in Russia. If you see what I mean. It's a great place too, though, but I ended up in Russia. Russia's fine. I like Russia. It's nice. Anyway, so let me tell everybody that we've been talking to Robin Greer today about her book, which she co-authored with Jerry Huff, called The Long Process of Development, Building Markets and States in Pre-Industrial England, Spain, and Their Colonies. Robin, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. And let me say to everybody who listens to this podcast, thank you very much for tuning in, and we hope to see you next week.